I was also reading and hearing about the creation of your twang. Mm. Would you tell us how that came to be?
Well, that came as while I'm playing with a group that I was telling you about, the Arizona Hayriders, Sunset Riders, whatever we called them, they called them. I'd also, you know, that disc jockey that I was telling you about in Coolidge, he got a job in a bigger market, and his dream came true, and he was gone. And so they sent a new guy in from Columbia School of Broadcasting. And a friend of mine who wanted to be a disc jockey said, "You got to come out and meet this new guy. He's a hoot." This was KCKY, Coolidge, Arizona. He says, so I went out there and I met this guy. He's a new DJ, and his name was Lee Hazelwood. And he'd been, you know, Columbia School of Broadcasting would send you out on your first job. They place you if you went through the whole school, which Lee did on his GI Bill or something. Went to the school and they placed him in Coolidge, and so I met him and we became friends, and our careers have been linked ever since for the next 50 some odd years, because he got the job in KCKY, and then he got a better job in at KRUX in Phoenix, and anyway, KTYM, I think it was, in Mesa. And while he's doing all these jobs as disc jockey, he's listening to these records in the studio with the nice speakers and everything, you know, because nicer than we had at home. And he's analyzing all these records he hears, and he's listening to the bass sound, the guitar sound, the drum sounds, and he wanted to make records. So Ramsey had a little studio, Floyd Ramsey, on North 7th Street, and Lee went in there one day and made a record called The Fool with Sanford Clark. And it became a top 10 record. And after they, it started out getting some action, so they leased it to Dot Records, who was at Pat Boone in those days. And it became a big top 10 hit. And Lee went to work for Dot for a year as a producer. Then he came back to Phoenix, and he wanted to make, and he started recording everybody in sight that was, that could sing or hum, and then he finally decided, well, I think we'll do, he said, "Dwayne, why don't you go home and write something? We'll do an instrumental." So I said, okay, and I went home and wrote a song called Moving and Groovin', and then we recorded it, and he had a partner who knew a label in Philadelphia, and the label in Philadelphia was named Jamie Records. They liked it and put it out, and it got about 70 in the charts. And they said, "Go back and do some more." So we went back in March of '58 and did Rebel Rouser, which was my first big hit, and The Lonely One, and a couple other tracks, Stalk, and I don't remember everything. Well, I remember everything eventually, but. I don't remember exactly what we all, how many we cut, but quite a few of them there, three or four or five. And but you were asking me how I came up with the sound. I had done a few sessions in the meantime, and before I started recording my own things, and I noticed that the high strings were really kind of puny, you know. And every rock and roll record had those da 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 da, you know, high string thing. So I thought, I'm going to do something different. So I went down to the bass strings, the low strings. And I also knew from what little recording I did that in the studio they had more power. You know, you had more guts and power from that. And I knew you had to have a melody. Otherwise, you know, because riffs I didn't think would sell unless you just had a really good one. And which I found a good one later in Peter Gunn. But you know, that's the exception, not the rule. And it had a great melody with the riff. So I wrote melodies like Rebel Rouser and things like The Lonely One and Cannonball and kind of a combination, some of them riffs and melodies. But that's how that started, in that low sound. And after Moving and Groovin' had a little high sound and a low sound, so I decided the low was better, so I wrote Rebel Rouser at the session one morning in March of '58, and that was huge hit that summer, and I've been at it ever since. Mm-hmm. Lee produced those first records and co-wrote a lot of them. And we split up later and went on our separate ways, and then we got together again when I signed with RCA, and that's another long story that's not worth telling. And then after that, 5 years later, 6-7 years later, why he was back not doing anything again, and he went over to Reprise and talked to Jimmy Bowen, who was running the label, and said he wanted to produce for, you know, if you got something I can do. And Jimmy says, I gave him the toughest axe I had, he said, at the time. He said, I couldn't do anything with him. He gave him the kids of the big stars, you know, Dean Martin's kids and Frank Sinatra's kids. He gave him Nancy Sinatra and Dino, Desi, and Billy, you know. And Lee got hits from both of them, you know, which was pretty clever. And, of course, he wrote this great song for Nancy called These Boots Are Made for Walking. And she's had a great career. He wasn't going to give it to her, but she insisted she picked the song, you know. It was.
I didn't know he'd written that.
Yeah. He was kind of afraid to show it to her because it was kind of a edgy song for the day, and he did not want to make Frank Sinatra mad. And so he just, you know, because he had a lot of respect and admiration for Frank, and he just didn't want to, you know, be the one to give his daughter this salty, these boots are made for walking, and one of these days they're going to walk all over you, you know.
And it's her signature piece.
Yeah. Turned out, well, she knew it. She knew it was a good song, and she heard it one day, I think by accident. She said, I want that song. He said, no, you can't have that. She says, I want that song. And guess what? She got that song.
When did you leave Arizona?
1962. I signed with RCA Victor in Hollywood. So I decided I needed to be over there instead of here because they wanted me to record in their studios. Not that we did. We snuck back several times and cut things here in Phoenix that were like Dance with a Guitar Man and a couple other things that became hits. And but we did a lot of it in Hollywood, too, because the studio there was great at the time. And the musicians, of course, were real experienced professional session musicians, you know, which we didn't have here. We had guys here were all guys that worked the honky-tonks and clubs, and it'd take us all day here to get a song where we wanted it, which they could do a couple of songs in 3 hours in Hollywood, because you had even I had jazz players like Barney Kessel and Howard Roberts that played guitar on the things, you know, rhythm guitar, but they knew what they were doing, and great, just great musicians all the way around.